You've heard me talk about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. I'm talking about Mood.com, which has created an entire line of functional gummies and flower crafted for your ideal mood, made with 100% federally legal THC. Not only that, but they'll deliver them directly to your doorstep so you can have your own clandestine herbal journey. You can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. What makes Mood.com's gummies different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. But their flower is what really blows me away. They partner with small, family-owned American farms who are custom cultivating their bud with unique terpene profiles, so you can choose a strain to help you feel more social, chilled out, or even more focused and productive. Best of all, not only does Mood.com stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you can get 20% off your first order with code JFK. So head to Mood.com and browse their amazing selection of functional gummies and flower and find the perfect one for whatever you're dealing with. Remember, use promo code JFK at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real, tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Today's bonus episode of Solving JFK features a conversation with the producer and director from the film Four Died Trying. Today we're joined by John Kirby and Libby Handros. Their series examines the lives and assassinations of President John F. Kennedy, Malcolm X, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Senator Robert F. Kennedy. Through more than 130 interviews with family members, colleagues, eyewitnesses, and other people who were connected to these events, their project asks a central question: what connects these four murders, and how did their deaths reshape American political history? Four Died Trying is being released in chapters. Each one is crafted as a standalone film, and the prologue is now available on major streaming platforms and introduces many of the themes that we'll carry through that series. So today we're going to talk with John and Libby and just kind of understand more about Four Died Trying. It's a really awesome project, and I'm honored to have you guys with me today. Welcome to Solving JFK.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks very much.
I watched the film when it first came out. You know, when you watch something the second time, it's a little more, you can kind of pick up more stuff, right? So I remember watching it when it came out and thinking it was good. I don't know that I finished it. I got pretty far and then something pulled me off track. But man, I watched it last night and it was incredible. It's so well done. You guys, I mean, my main takeaway was that the first episode, the prologue episode, it's just a really, really good sort of entrance into the whole concept for anybody who's kind of not familiar with it. So I don't want to give the whole thing away just by telling you how great it was, but the production in particular is really, really strong. Like all the transitions and the animations and the sort of the vintage vibe of everything. I just thought it was really well done.
Oh, thanks so much. It's great to hear that. We worked hard on it. We're in year 10 now.
I want to hear all about that. So I guess just to start from the top,
What are your respective backgrounds? I know, John, you're the director, and Libby, you're the producer, but how professionally, what gave you sort of the skill sets to be able to put this thing together in such an excellent way?
Well, I think my background is, in investigative journalism and particularly investigative documentary journalism. And so this is a piece of investigative journalism, and investigative journalism is storytelling. And so therefore, I've been working in this field since 1983, first on a series called Inside Story with Hodding Carter, which was the first criticism series ever to appear regularly on television. And that did mini documentaries about press issues. And then we went on to do more long form documentaries. And the notions that underlie Fourth Eye Trying are things I've been looking at along with my business partner, John, here now for years. We did a film with Lewis Lapham, the editor of Harper's Magazine, called The American Ruling Class, which is a dramatic documentary musical which looks at who the ruling class is. And of course, this project intersects with the deep state and the ruling class because what were these four men doing that angered that group so much that they had to be assassinated? So it's been in my wheelhouse for decades.
Right.
Yeah,
Okay,
and
cool.
I should clarify, everyone, it's Inside Story is different from Inside Edition. People often think that, but Inside Story, what that Libby worked on for so long, was a PBS show that ran for a number of seasons, and it was the first nationally televised press criticism show. I have came to work with Libby on a project we did with Lewis Lapham. Actually, it was an examination of the media and the triumph of the tabloid press that we did with Lewis. And but I come from working on, films for HBO and other networks. And Libby and I did the American Ruling Class for the BBC and the Sundance Channel. And we've gone on to do many other projects together for film festivals, theatrical release, and other another venues, from Discovery Channel to you name it. So, I think that what we're fortunate enough to combine, or the kind of the unicorn here, is that we do come from a traditional broadcast background, but we always, both of us in our lives and careers, were interested in things that went beyond the scope of normal broadcast television. So we're bringing that kind of oddball combination of having some production chops with an interest in this forbidden history.
Sure. And so Fourth Eye Trying, just in terms of the how you guys got together, and what the genesis was for the project, can you just kind of walk me through that?
Yeah, we had a friend named Nick Bryant who actually did the most some of the most important work, I would say, on the Epstein files. He did that work years ago, before anyone was talking about it, before it was okay to speak about in polite society. He had broken that story, along with the story of the Franklin scandal, which is equally, or if not more, disturbing. And so I discovered Nick through reading his work, and Nick put us together with somebody who had an interesting idea, which was, what do the children of the assassinated think about what happened to their parents? And to make a long story short, we agreed with this person who has, got a lot of money to do a first. It was a film. And then it evolved into kind of an episodic series, and it's evolved since then into a kind of a franchise of feature films. And that happened for a number of reasons. It ended up taking, for instance, months and years sometimes to get, for instance, the King family to sit down and talk, or Bobby Kennedy Jr. Or, I mean, we knew five people in common with Bobby Kennedy Jr., and we couldn't get that interview to happen as quickly as we would have liked. So, and that was the case throughout all these interviews. And many of our interviews are final interviews. I mean, we probably had the last interview with someone like Mort Saul, who was the president's joke writer, along with being probably the first significant political comedian. He was, he became an investigator for Jim Garrison, interestingly enough, after being probably the most highest paid comedian to that point in history, and Dick Gregory and speech writers for the Kennedys. And so this, it expanded by mutual agreement with our partner into a much bigger thing than it started. And so that's why we've decided that this format, you know, these days you can format things in so many ways. We could chop it up into little episodes later, but we're going to be releasing a film at a time. Right now we're being suppressed, but that's another story.
Okay, well, I want to come back to that, the suppression. So what you're covering is, so it's four people, and of course it's easy to put them together because, you know, that all happened, they're all, you know, political assassinations of the 1960s. And in watching the film again last night, what struck me is the theme I noticed is that they all were vocally against the Vietnam War. Now, Kennedy was killed earlier on, so he maybe not vocally so much, but they all were sort of against the Vietnam War. Do you think that, and just sort of anti-imperialism generally, is what brings them together? Or is there another, aside from just being the political assassinations of the 60s, like what do you guys see in those assassinations and in those people that makes you kind of want to cover them all together?
Well, it's beyond the Vietnam War. All four men actually were for peace, and they didn't want the foreign entanglements. And so Kennedy, at the end of his life, was making rapprochement with Khrushchev. And Martin Luther King, of course, was a peace activist. And so was Malcolm X. I mean, he came out against the war in Vietnam long before anybody else did. So it's not just the war in Vietnam. It's the whole notion of peace and not having all these little wars all over the world. And it's not healthy to be for peace because, of course, there's something called the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, but if you go down the list, right, you look at starting with Kennedy, I mean, there wasn't a sector of the establishment that he didn't upset, right? So he's at war with the steel combine, you know, he's going to get rid of the oil depletion allowance. He's making, as Libby said, rapprochement with Khrushchev. He's doing the same with Castro. He's talking about full withdrawal from Vietnam, which was a action that he had inherited. You know, even though he was definitely an anti-communist, you know, which though some of the people who ended up killing him probably thought he was soft on communism, but he wasn't. He wasn't interested in capitulating to communism. He just thought that the whole way we were going about it was wrong. And I can tell you more about what's going to happen in film one, where we really explore. It's called Jack Joins the Revolution, and we really explore his anti-colonialism, his anti-imperialism. But if you go down the list with Kennedy, I mean, everything, you know, and then he and his brother are going after the mob, you know, which is a tangled story because of his father. So down the list you go. Then you get to Malcolm. Malcolm, you know, had basically softened his kind of race-based approach to some degree. He was going to use the UN as a means of going after the United States for human rights abuses against its black citizens. But he was coming together with people like King, and, you know, the two of them together was a terrifying prospect to people like J. Edgar Hoover. And, you know, Malcolm gets a very bad rap. People think he was like some kind of, you know, pro-militant violence kind of guy. He was about protecting people by any means necessary from, you know, corruption and racism. But he, in the end, he had become this amazing international figure. He was beloved all over the world, and he was becoming a major Cold War embarrassment. He was about to show up at this conference called the Badung Conference, where he would have been speaking to all these third world leaders. So he was a major threat in that regard. They were fearful of the rise of what they call the Black Messiah. J. Edgar Hoover writes about that in there are many places that shows up in the FBI files. Then, of course, King is not only he makes a speech April 4th, 1967, where he formally announces his opposition to the Vietnam War and what is probably his best speech. It's a devastating speech where he calls out the war crimes of our, you know, our national security state. And he was also gathering on the political economic front. He was gathering people, poor people of all races, to Washington, as you see in the prologue, as we, you know, briefly sketch. And, you know, that was a terrifying prospect to the powers that be, to have a real kind of Occupy Washington, where these people would not leave, of all races, because, of course, the major, you know, the major, however they go about doing it, whether it's through sort of naked old school racist policies or new school woke policies, the idea of dividing people along racial identity is very crucial to the ruling class. So they loved that. He was saying, forget about that. Let's all get together. We're going to encamp on the Washington Mall until Congress does something about poverty. And, you know, very, very scary. So a year to the day after he made the speech that connected poverty at home to the war abroad, he was killed April 4th, 1968. Then you get to Bobby, and Bobby, of course, you know, knew in ways that he could not express publicly who killed his brother. And he was looking into that. And he made the, you know, decision to run reluctantly because he understood that there were guns between him and the White House, as he's told a friend. And he also didn't want it to look like it was a vendetta against Johnson, et cetera. But he was going to pull us out of the Vietnam War. And he was making a kind of a connection to, you know, impoverished farm workers and, you know, the dispossessed throughout this country, Appalachia, the ghettos. He was really, he always had a kind of a priest-like mission, you know, a kind of a sense of mission. But he was taking that to a level that I think was very scary to the establishment. And they just didn't want to see him in a place where he could possibly wield the instruments of government to go after the perpetrators of his brother's death, for instance, and to kill the cash cow that was the Vietnam War. So, you know, these guys, they all intersect, and kind of one killing almost couldn't have happened without the other. And there are many other killings, from Lumumba to Dag Hammarskjöld to Fred Hampton, that kind of get covered as we go, you know, culminating in people like John Lennon. But these, you know, the state has always, you know, state crimes against democracy have always included assassinations, and those were the four big ones, and they did forever alter the world that we live in.
Yeah, absolutely. So the way you've done this, so I saw on your website 130 interviews. Is that about right? Is that, you've interviewed a lot of people. I guess my question, a few questions, then I want to talk about some of the specific people you interview, because as I'm watching and I'm going, no way, that's, they didn't get Marita Lorenz. That's not Marita. That's Marita. I'm just like yelling at the TV. When you do these interviews, are you, because you know you're not going to get that many shots at the people, how far down the road do you have the project mapped out such that you would be able to get all of the information you need to get when you interview them? I guess I'm asking kind of like a procedural question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, initially, to begin with, we had a huge board. And as names would come up, I mean, a lot of documentaries are made where you read one book and then, you know, all those interviews are kind of there in the book. Like my ex-boss, Alex Gibney, makes great documentaries this way, you know, and the writer has basically gotten all the interview subjects you need right there. Now, we had four major historical figures to do, and we were kind of rewriting the political history of the country, and it took hundreds and hundreds of books and hundreds of articles. And as we are running into things and we're finding new leads and going from one place to another, and it's like, okay, this person, I've got to get her before she, and we're also racing the clock, right? Because a lot of these people are older now. So we're doing, that's the procedure. And then of course, as we're sort of imbibing all this, you know, the former head of HBO Films used to say that you could solve these kinds of crimes in the editing room, right? Because you're kind of putting it all together and it kind of, the pattern becomes very clear. And so we're, you know, various ideas that we had going in, changed and evolved and grew. So, you know, meeting Vince Salandria, who I saw in your questions, you know, I mean, Vince Salandria, for people who don't know, I mean, he gives us, I mean, Jim Douglas himself, who wrote, of course, the great JFK and the Unspeakable, why he died and why it matters. He helped set us off on this course. He was a friend of ours at the time. And when we got this gig, we reached out to him because we'd been on this kind of path before we even were connected with this executive producer. So in any event, you know, Vince gives you a concept like the false mystery, right? Which is something we can talk about later if you want. And so, you know, you run down the field with that and all the things that make this, the Kennedy assassination in particular, a false mystery. And then, you know, you look at the divide in the camps between, you know, the people who are like, oh, it's the mob, it's the CIA, it's Lyndon Johnson, et cetera. And then you're like, wait a second, isn't there something that ties all of this together? I mean, are people being a little bit unnecessarily exclusionary? And so recently we've been fleshing out a whole area that hadn't, that we hadn't started with fleshing out before. So it's an iterative process, as Libby's fond of saying, and it's a cumulative process and it's an associative process. And a lot of stuff is happening as we go.
And not every, and most of the people we interviewed did not say yes the first time around.
Well, yeah.
It took years to get some of those people, as John was saying, and it really was a process. And we actually read all their books. So we'd sit down and talk to somebody and they'd be like, oh my God, you read our book all the way through, or you read all of my books all the way through and the background books as well.
So who actually did the interviews? Did you guys just split them up or?
Yeah. I mean, it would depend. I mean, for instance, Sandy
Serrano
really wasn't comfortable talking to a guy, you know, for instance, and Kathleen Kennedy Townsend wasn't comfortable talking to a woman. So, you know, sometimes it gets split like that. You know, I mean, because I'm also the editor, I often like to take the lead in asking the questions, but Libby and I will have worked up those questions for days beforehand and weeks when you consider all the reading that has to be done. So it will really depend on the situation. And sometimes we just hand it back and forth as we're sitting there.
And we went in with very prepared questions because actually, if you do your questions correctly, they should tell a story.
Yeah.
The questions should tell a story and the answers flesh out that story.
Yeah. Yeah, and James Douglas, one of the guys that you interviewed, the way that he writes, he kind of writes like thematically like that, like, you know, in JFK and the Unspeakable, I think it's like Washington and Dallas, or it's like Saigon and Chicago, I think is it, or the chapter. Mm. I could see that being an influence on what you guys were doing. He's got a new book out too called Martyrs to the Unspeakable, which is really good.
But he really was our spiritual guide, and he's the one, you know, I was... You know, this is many years ago now, but I was incredibly ignorant, and I was ignorant of Vince Salandria, who, he dedicates in part JFK and the Unspeakable too. So we were very lucky to obviously to know Jim, to talk to Jim, and then we were incredibly fortunate to talk to Vince, because very few people have ever gotten to do a sit down interview with Vince Salandria, and he really is the godfather of all Kennedy researchers. Mark Lane, everybody sat at his knee because, of course, he figured it out with his brother-in-law on assassination weekend. Yeah. But that's another story.
Let's talk about the false, what did you call it? The false mystery?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is Vince's concept of false mystery. And, you know, what it means is that everything that you need to know about this is right there. It's all not even hidden in plain sight. It's staring at us in the face. The real mystery is not who did it. The mystery is really in us. Why do we, I mean, this is my addition to the concept of false mystery, but that's the real mystery. It's like, what prevents us from really doing something about this or seeing it when it's so clear, right? So for instance, he'll use the examples of, you know, the crime scene is destroyed immediately. Like everything you can need to know about, like who did it, is right there, right? Because they take Governor Connolly's clothes to the dry cleaners immediately. They bang out the dents in the limousine and send it back to Ford and wash out all the blood. And they let the prime suspect be killed while in police custody. I mean, or the alleged prime suspect. So, you know, he and his brother-in-law, and I'll just tell the short version of this story, were sitting there assassination weekend. I mean, you have to remember about Vince. In eighth grade, he stood in front of his math class right after Pearl Harbor. And he said, you know, the whole idea that this came as a surprise to the American national security state is totally ridiculous. It was, in fact, a provoked attack in order to push a recalcitrant public into the war, a recalcitrant American public. And of course, he's been totally borne out by everything from cables and other historians. I mean, he did that in eighth grade. So he was like 12 or 13, right? So now, fast forward, he's sitting there on assassination weekend with his brother-in-law, and they are watching as Oswald's being taken around, and he says, "I'm just a patsy." And at that point, they say to each other, "Okay, well, give them the benefit of the doubt. Well, if he lasts through the weekend and gets to trial, then it is what the authorities are saying it is. And if he dies by the end of the weekend, we'll know that this was a national security state killing ordered at the highest level." And there, you know, there are a series of logical steps you can actually just get to realize that. Another aspect of the false mystery of this is the communications that were sent to both the cabinet plane that was flying back from the conference in Hawaii and Air Force One with these people who had just been part of this traumatic event. And what's the message? An hour after Oswald's captured, they basically say, "We got the guy. There is no conspiracy. That's it. Case closed." And as Vince puts it so powerfully in our film, they're basically saying, "We don't care what you heard or what you saw or what you smelled." And these were guys who were combat veterans who knew they were in an ambush. "We're going to say who did it. And you're going to say what we say, period. That's it." So right there, they're just telling you, they're being brazen about it. And so, you know, he reads the Warren report. He realized, okay, they've got all these witnesses that say they heard shots coming from over here. And they've got these witnesses that say they heard them from over there. And they've got other witnesses that they heard both. And yet they don't put it all together. They're not really trying to figure it out. So that's another clue that shows you this is a false mystery and that the people at the highest levels are the ones that ordered this killing.
And by the way, the people who spoke out and said, "I heard this, I saw that, et cetera," I think it's 90 some odd people, they did not have long lives. It was not good for your longevity to have very publicly kept saying that you disagreed with what was in the Warren report.
Right, especially if you had some kind of firsthand information. You know, a lot of those, as we know, eyewitnesses died.
Right. And they, a lot of them, they go, "Oh, single car accident, heart attack, heart attack, heart attack." And then 10, 12 years later, they show everybody the heart attack gun during the church committee hearings. So it's like,
excellent point. Yeah. They've been able to induce that for a long time.
Right. Right. Toxic shellfish, turns out. Hell of a drug. So
I did a program on foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor, and the investigative journalist who wrote the book on that died of shellfish poisoning over the Atlantic.
Yeah, bad airplane food. But he was going to reveal too much. Like, can't even talk about Pearl Harbor. You can't even talk about the Reichstag fire all these years later. And that was Nazis. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
It might have been Nazis involved in JFK.
Yeah.
Otto Skorzeny angle. We can. I'm going to have to unpack that at some point. So we'll look at it.
Well, you're going to have to interview Hank Abarelli's co-writer, who's still alive, Leslie.
I met her briefly in Dallas in 2022. I'd love to do that. So,
learning a new language is one of those skills that truly stays with you. And it's incredibly rewarding once you start hearing yourself understand and speak it naturally. Rosetta Stone makes it simple to get started and easy to keep going when it comes to learning a new language. You've probably heard of Rosetta Stone. They've been the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you truly pick up your new language naturally. There's no memorizing random vocabulary lists or feeling lost. For me, I've always wanted to travel to Spain, so I know that when I make that trip, I'm going to be speaking the best Espanol that I can possibly speak, and I'm going to do it with the help of Rosetta Stone. Another great thing about Rosetta Stone is that they help you speak with the appropriate accent so you don't sound like a weirdo in some other country. With 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more, Rosetta Stone is the go-to tool for real language growth. You'll learn faster and retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence. No English translations, so you truly learn to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. And you can learn from anywhere. Rosetta Stone fits your lifestyle with flexible on-the-go learning. You can access lessons from your desktop or the mobile app, whether you just have 5 minutes or for an hour. So don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Solving JFK listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. That's rosettastone.com/today to start learning right away. This episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
You know, one thing I've learned from just studying JFK, not the other three gentlemen, is just that it's so vast that it's really hard to, especially if I was going to make a film or try to... a documentary, even like a themed series, like to try to figure out how to attack it, you know what I mean? How to take a bite at the apple. It's so big, and to think where to go. I know it's a real challenge for JFK. So my question to you is, given that you have four of them, where is everything going, and what's next? And do you have an approximate timeline?
Do you want me to
go ahead? You can talk about the next film,
well,
et cetera.
You know, basically, as I say, you got to let this, because we're not doing it from a script that we've pre-written where we're, you know, and we're not doing it from a book that somebody else did, and we're putting it together. You put it together from the materials on hand, and that's the living witnesses, right? And sometimes, you know, so that's why, for instance, just doing the kids wasn't going to cut it, because not all the kids have all the story, right? And it was a really... pardon me, important to us to talk to people like Paul Schrade, who was, you know, the guy who was one of the guys who was shot along with Bobby Kennedy the night at the Ambassador. He was the labor advisor to Kennedy. And we were able to speak with him before he died. He had been, you know, really working hard to get Sirhan Sirhan freed from prison, because the ballistics showed that Sirhan Sirhan could not have killed Bobby. So we go with the, you have to lean into what you have and answer your question, like, how do you deal with this giant, you know, case? You know, so there's going to be a bias towards, you know, the people like Marita Lorenz or Sandy Serrano or the people that we were able to speak with. Sometimes you try to get interviews that you can't get, or, you know, you just missed them by months or weeks or whatever, and they're dead now. But I think each of those people provides a window into what is a shared reality. Each of them will take you to the same place. I mean, obviously there are some that are, you could argue, are misinformation, or they're certainly partial, but really what I think sets us apart is we have a major focus on what these people were doing. That's woven throughout. And that's what Jim Douglas does in his books. You know, you really learn what these people were, what they were about. And in learning what they're about, you learn who their enemies were. And in learning who their enemies were, you learn what happened to them. So the next film that is currently being suppressed right now is called Jack Joins the Revolution. And it's a combination of stories. It you know, we realized that people didn't understand the Red Scare and the Cold War. Like people, you know, younger than me, you know, they just weren't around for that. So and you know, COVID and the COVID lockdown period sort of has some analogies to the Red Scare. But, sure. You know, we wanted to make sure that people really got what the Red Scare meant. And so what it meant for Kennedy to not be a McCarthyite. His brother did work on McCarthy's committee for a moment, but he got out of it. You know, they kind of saw McCarthy as a kind of a funny figure. But, you know, what he, and not just him, but that whole period did to the country was terrible. I mean, there are people who defend McCarthy now saying, okay, there were, you know, so-called communists in the government. Be that as it may, the way in which the Red Scare was conducted in the United States had a terrible effect on freedom of speech, freedom of thought, and just human progress in general. So I think even, you know, libertarian and conservative friends of ours who are appreciating McCarthy in some ways now really need to think about that, because the way in which this country, the being in this country from 1947 to about 1960 was terrible. If you were any kind of an iconoclastic thinker or a creative person, Matt, I don't want to interrupt. Did you want to add something? You looked like you wanted to talk. Anyway,
I'm just agreeing with what you're saying, just because this the idea of, yeah, I've always been very troubled by the McCarthy period. Oh yes, I know, pat myself on the back. I know I'm so forward thinking, but the reason why is it's just a slippery slope. It's one thing to go, oh, communism's evil and we're fighting a battle against communism, our geopolitical enemy, the Soviet Union. Okay, I can get my head around that. But then when you apply it to, hey, this person wants to have like a reasonable social safety net, I don't know, sounds might be a communist. So the point is, it basically precludes, you know, thought, free thought.
That's right. We'll send you an advanced copy of the film. You're right on target that it precluded all kinds of free thought and creative thought and any kind. And people became really timid and frightened. So it's actually, film one is a kind of combination biography of Kennedy's early life, where you see his war experience, that story that John Hershey and Jim Douglas recount of his, you know, trying to save his PT crewmen by floating out in the Pacific, that's in there. You know, where he comes from, you know, his Irish heritage. This is something that doesn't really get talked about a lot, and it's really important, because as wealthy as his father became, they never lost sight of their roots. They were real kind of famine Irish, not Scots Irish. They were famine Irish who came over in the 1850s and, you know, got involved in the kind of urban political landscape and never lost sight of the fact that they came from an oppressed people that had been, you know, under the heel of the British for 700-800 years. So that is really, so despite all Kennedy's privilege, he's got that deep in his soul, so that when he is in Congress, he becomes the head of the Subcommittee on African Affairs. And so he is very sympathetic to anti-colonial struggles all over the world. And that's something that we talk about in this film. So on the one hand, so after the war, you know, you've got all of these third world and, these colonial countries breaking the bonds and he's saying, we've got to help these countries. We've got to be the beacon for them. And no one really talks about this about Kennedy. The evidence is overwhelming. He makes this speech, which Jim Douglas does mention, about Algeria, which of course is a French colony. And it's struggling for its independence and, you know, violently struggling for it. And Kennedy's saying, the French have got to withdraw. They've got to go. He's even saying this about them in Vietnam. He's saying they've overstayed their welcome. And he's coming back as a young congressman saying this on the news. And we've got the clips. So here you've got a guy who's very clearly for, he's against imperialism, whether it comes from the left, or I should say, from the West or from the Soviets. And at the same time, you've got the rise of the CIA. And that's also in our film. So you've got this, you know, and the Dulles brothers, right? So you've got this collision course, right, where's the camera? You've got this collision course happening between, you know, Dulles and all the people that he represents and Kennedy and that spirit of freedom that's overtaking the globe. And you know, as what we think is one of the greatest, and you know, and he's at home, he's being said, well, what do you think about all the communism at home? He's like, well, I think that's not really such a big deal. I think we've basically dealt with that. What I'm worried about is more this. And he comes out on the campaign trail and he blames the US and its neo-colonial policies for the rise of Castro. He's like, look, Batista was the number two guy in Batista's government in Cuba was the American ambassador. So we have nobody but ourselves to blame if, you know, these people were responsive to a guy who was saying, I'm going to cure all the problems and get rid of this, you know, U.S.-backed thug, Batista. He's like, we're on the wrong side of history here, guys. That's his literal campaign. That's how he's campaigning, which is like, you can't even imagine that today. You know, it's just unthinkable. And so just to quickly finish, so in this context, you've got, and then, so the Red Scare is happening when you're supposed to just be like all meek and, you know, people were afraid to sign, as you'll see in film one, they were afraid to sign a petition that was taken directly out of the Declaration of Independence because they thought it sounded too subversive. So that's the mindset we're dealing with when he comes into office and he actually goes to see a blacklisted film. A film by a former blacklisted author. He goes to see Spartacus. He sneaks out of the White House to do it. And he goes with his friend Red Fay from the PT boats. And it's an incredible story because he basically ends the whole Red Scare in that moment, in that night, by going to see that movie. Everyone sees it. The manager turns the lights on and says, Mr. President Kennedy's here. And everyone stands up and gives him a standing ovation. It makes all the newspapers. And basically the Red Scare is over at that moment.
Well, I didn't know that story. That's cool. You said that it was being suppressed. The first episode, prologue is out now. Then there's episode one. So can you speak about that or no?
We can to some degree. We are in a dispute with our backer over the release strategy. Okay. We started to release the films and he changed his mind on that and is stopping us from doing any further releases. And so we're trying to resolve that situation so we can keep releasing.
In the courts. Okay. So, you know, and it's very unclear why he flipped around. You know, it's either sort of a lack of understanding of the business, because we'd already told everyone what we were doing and he had agreed to it. And a lack of understanding of the particular situation that we were in, or he's being influenced by, you know, there is a guy who hovers around this with a really weird background. So it's unclear, you know, exactly why it's happening, but we're basically fighting this out in the courts right now. We were forced to sue him.
Wow.
So that's how these things happen. That's how, you know, could be COINTELPRO, could just be stupidity, but that's where we're at.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. So, you know, right now, of course, we have the task force on government secrets, and you know, it's not going to heal the world. It's not like the solution to everyone's problems. I would say vis-a-vis JFK, and MLK, better to have had those hearings than not, but it's not like it's, you know what I'm saying? Like some earth shattering thing. So aside from I bring up the task force because that's something that's actually the government. It's Congress. Now, you know, a critic could fairly say that this is really just people trying to win political points and et cetera. And I think there's probably some truth to that as well. But what can we do at this point, I guess? Because I, you know, I talk a lot about what can we do when it comes to JFK. But you know, RFK, MLK, Malcolm X, is it a truth and reconciliation like hearings? Like what would that look like? I guess yeah, I'm just curious, like if you could have it your way to tie a bow on all these things so that you know we move forward with at least a common understanding of history. I don't know.
Well, you know, I was the co-chair of a Truth and Reconciliation Committee that was started, that was the brainchild of David Talbot. And myself and Dan Sorper were the co-chairs of that. And Dan, of course, passed away, I guess, last summer now. And the idea was for new hearings. The problem with hearings is there's still a vast, vast body of papers that are not being released. The AARB, the Archives Assassination
Records.
Assassination Records Review Board.
Records Review Board identified tons more papers that still need to be released. And they're still finding more. I mean, I have to say, the Luma people did a great job unearthing a lot of things. And it may be that it is the false mystery. We have already solved it. And all that these papers are going to show us are little details. And you've got to, you know, sketch, stitch the little details together. On the King assassination, one of the problems is all the wiretaps picked up very personal details of the lives of the kids. And so they've got to go through all of that first. And of course, Malcolm X's family has launched a $100 million lawsuit in the courts, wrongful death suit. That's a brilliant document.
I think that the answer is going to be to continue to educate ourselves as much as possible. I don't think that you know, it's not going to be handed to us on a silver platter. It's not going to be like, okay, now we've got justice. People have to basically, we all have to basically continue the process of growing up. And growing up in this case means facing the unspeakable, as Jim Douglas would call it. And the more sophisticated we are in regards to that, as depressing a journey as that can be, it's ultimately hopeful because without having that kind of core wisdom and understanding to face the unspeakable, these things are just going to keep happening, and they get more and more sophisticated. So you get things like 9/11, or you get things like the COVID lockdowns, and so they up the game, and without a background in this stuff, it really is incumbent on us to learn our history, to do our own thinking and do our own research, something that was demonized during the COVID period, and learn about and I think learning about what these guys were doing is such a great starting point, because that's where we should be going. So it may be too late to, you know, bring a lot of the perpetrators to justice, but it's not too late to kind of set ourselves down a path that looks something more like what they were doing, which is about coming up with the kind of moral equivalent to war. You know, Kennedy wanted that to be space exploration and doing things here at home to improve the situation of everyone, through things that became perverted, like the Alliance for Progress, USAID, and the Peace Corps. There is so much work to do at home to keep us busy, to make us better in so many ways. And so life need not be boring without war. So there's a way to do this. And that's, you know, studying their path, I think is a great first step. You know, waiting around for the next, for the big unredacted document. You know, they've had all this time to make whatever documents they want.
And the document isn't going to be, you know, J. Edgar Hoover, you know, memo from J. Edgar Hoover to Lyndon Johnson. On this date, we're going to do this, and we've hired these people and that and that.
CC Allen Dulles
Yeah, I
or
mean,
Allen, whatever.
there's pieces around, and people will stitch it all together in different ways. But it really is, I think, once you understand, as John was saying, what they were doing and who they were angering, then you can understand it.
Then you can understand your world better, and you can understand kind of what we need to do better. because that's been lost.
I think Oliver Stone kind of showed everyone that, look, if you want to influence culture and you want to really move the discussion, the medium of a film seems to be the move. I mean, it's, you know, film,
absolutely.
TV, you know.
I saw it when I was 20. I came out of the movie theater, and I will, I'm only somewhat ashamed to say I wept in my girlfriend's arms. I mean, she wasn't as affected as I was, but you know, I really, I knew that. And as we've since had the opportunity to interview him and Zachary Sklar, his screenwriter.
Yeah,
so that
yeah.
was great, kind of full circle for me. I knew intuitively that there was a huge truth being told in that film, and he did it so brilliantly and so powerfully. And then you get the book of the screenplay, if you ever get it, and every line of the screenplay is backed up with footnotes. So that
right.
they did an amazing, amazing job. And, I agree with you that film and conversations like this are a powerful way to get it out. And, you know, people really, you know, they have to read, they have to, you know, they have to research, they have to watch, you know, important films and documentaries, and they've got to arm themselves against, because, you know, the same mentality, whether the same people are involved or not, the same structures and the same kind of MO is always at work, and the same contempt for people. I mean, I remember Dulles saying about the Warren Report, right? He said, nobody in America reads anyway. So, you know, so he basically felt they can get away with anything, because we're just, you know, we're going to want to just, you know, eat ho-hos and, you know, surf the web and we'll shut up. But we have to not be that way. And then maybe we'll get a better life out of it all.
One thing I would like to really, and this, I agree with everything you just said. One thing I'd like to see concrete done on these four assassinations is to provide a little bit of balance to the textbooks, like to the mainstream, because I just think, you know, like, look, JFK, that's the one I know about, so we'll talk about that one. I don't think we're going to get, you know, what's the big textbook writer? I can't, it's Macmillan.
McGraw-Hill.
McGraw-Hill, yeah. I don't know that we're going to get McGraw-Hill to you know, say that, you know, there was a shooter on the grassy knoll. But what they should do at a minimum is state the conclusion of the HSCA, state the existence of the ARRB, and then state that the files still remain classified. If you could just put
or
it in
that
paragraph.
Yeah, and just they could even take it all the way up to present day and say that in 2023, you know, the president said we're going to release the files, and it became very hard to release the files, and there's still a lot of them that are missing. So
right.
Yeah, exactly. And
well, you're talking about a world in which textbooks were actually interested in teaching history, which is, you know,
right.
Maybe step one would be that, because, you know, it's just what Frederick Douglass's slave master said to his wife, who was trying to teach him to read. It's like, you know, we don't do that. An educated slave is going to free themselves. So,
yeah.
So, that's the problem.
And the GI Bill of Rights, sorry.
Okay, Libby, I'm
the
sorry.
GI Bill of Rights sent a huge generation of kids to school and to college more than ever before. And what happened is their kids graduated and didn't want to go fight in the Vietnam War. So they've learned some very hard lessons.
I actually had a profound thought, believe it or not. So we're at this intersection of, like, the point where we zoom into this insane AI future. And of course there's no grown-ups in the room, and, you know, that concerning, the future is looking concerning even for an optimist like myself. But it just really strikes me that the clock is sort of ticking on what we're trying to do, because trying to get people to pay attention to it before AI started to take over life was a real challenge. And now it's like, why should I care about this? And, you know, the answer is like, well, because it very well may have been a coup and nothing you believe is real. That's why you should care. But they kind of go, I don't know. It seems a long time ago, and the world's crazy anyway. It's just, we just That's the challenge, and I don't know how to get my head around that, but I think you guys are fighting the good fight. But yeah, do you have any thoughts
Well,
on that?
I think that, our friend Lewis Lapham started, who was the editor of Harper's Magazine. He started a history quarterly called Lapham's Quarterly, where they would take kind of one topic, war, love, the sea, money, and do like 2, 3,000 years of writers on that topic. And what you get from the consolations of history is the understanding that we've been here before, that all kinds of civilizations and different eras have gone through almost identical history, as they say, right? Doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And we've heard this rhyme many, many times before. So that's the crucial thing. I mean, the founders were hearing this rhyme. The Declaration of Independence is a document accusing the British Crown of conspiracy. It's basically saying you're hiring, these Indians to do raids on us. You're sabotaging our economy. You're doing all this stuff that's nefarious that, not everyone knows about, but we know you're doing it. And they eventually have the gumption to have a revolution. So if as he was fond of quoting, and I'm going to forget who said what, but he who does not have 3,000 years of history at his beck and call is living hand to mouth. And what was the other one? To not know one's past is to forever remain a child. And so this is an answer to the AI people who say, oh, well, what does that matter now that we've got this? You're going to be completely rudderless in an AI universe where reality can be shaped if you don't have any mooring in the past. They've been faking photos or in an Orwellian fashion, rewriting history for a long time, but this just gives them a new tool. But if you are going to be completely lost without the anchor of history. That's why everyone's got to read history, mainstream history, alternative history, read all the history that you can. And then you might have your bearings, we know the old Santayana saying, if you don't do that, you'll be condemned to repeat it because that's what we've been doing. We've been repeating these cycles of history. I mean, the Reichstag fire, the Nazis burn down their own government building and take over. That model is the reason why they don't even talk about that today. I've been to the Reichstag Museum and wandered around Berlin. They don't like to admit that that happened today because that same kind of thing happens all the time up into our lifetimes. So the idea that governments can do stuff like that is like, ugh. So it's like we gotta learn that kind of history and the basic history. What are the good things about this country, the founding of this country, the tools that gave people like Kennedy felt he could do something with this. He could do something with the American presidency. He could make America be, in Langston Hughes's phrase. He could, he could have it, emerge. He or what's the fulfill itself? What do they say? Actualize. He could make it actualize. So anyway, that's the whole key. That everyone who says, why do I look at that? It's because if you don't look at that, you aren't going to have a clue about the future.
Yeah, but it's just so well done, and I'm gonna watch everyone as soon as it comes out. I'll be retweeting you guys and promoting you going forward, and I'm a fan. And one last thing, did I hallucinate? Which is possible. Mood.com. Just kidding. Did I hallucinate or did I see you, John, on a show with someone wearing a Grassy Knoll t-shirt?
Yeah, no, you saw that, and I
Okay.
almost wore it again tonight. Yeah, that was
All right. I was like,
yeah.
dude, I designed that shirt. That's what my man.
Was that your shirt?
That's my shirt, yeah.
Nothing
Are
to
you
see
kidding?
here.
Nothing
Nothing
to
to see
see
here.
here's your shirt.
That's
That's
mine.
my
Yeah, it's my
favorite
design.
shirt. That's
Yeah.
my favorite shirt. I almost wore it. I didn't want to
Yeah,
like.
he wears it all the time.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's my shirt. I designed that like in season one.
It's a brilliant design. It's hysterical. I mean, in a macabre sort of way, but very campy and fun. And
Right.
I love wearing that shirt. So you're a graphic artist as well?
No, I just thought like it would be a funny idea to have like to have a like a postcard of Dealey Plaza with nothing to see here coming up and smoke from the grassy knoll. You know what I mean? Like
Oh, can I buy it as a postcard as well?
Well, no, that's like what it's based on, the
That's the
design
concept.
of
Okay.
it.
Well, I
But
think now you
yeah.
have to make postcards of it, because
Yeah.
I would use those as my Christmas cards. Like I have like five of these, which shows like,
Amazing.
you know, the descent of man into sheep. So I have like
Oh, I
five of
like
these.
that. Oh, I'll have to get one
Yeah.
of those. That's not,
Yeah, they're
if you
just
can have something that's got like commentary that's not too obvious, you know what I mean? The only people who are paying attention will notice it. Those are the kind of things I like to do. But
Yes, yeah.
guys, I gotta
Brilliant.
run, but it was such an honor to speak to you, and I look forward to talking to you again. And I'm a fan of your work, and you've got a supporter in me.
Well,
Thank you so
and
much.
likewise, keep sending me shirt links. I'm going to be your number one
Oh,
customer.
definitely.
Cheers. All
All
right.
right,
Thanks
thank
guys
you
so
for
much.
that.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Have a good night.
You too.
Bye-bye.